For those who have been following this series on the murder of Hakeem Clark, it should be obvious that in this case, the investigation Detective Santoro put together was solid. So how is it that Hakeem's killer, Quaison Lee, was out of prison and shooting at people again in 2024? Listen in as we discuss how the Chatham County District Attorney's Office dropped the ball on this case with disastrous results. And welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I am Christy Barker, and we are doing something different this time, in part because I don't want to listen to myself talk for an hour without a break, and I don't think anybody else does either, but I have a lot to say about what happened to the case of Quaison Lee and what happened with Hakeem Clark's murder prosecution, or the prosecution of Hakeem Clark's murder. And so what we've decided to do, Rob Santoro has very kindly offered to interview me about this. So welcome back, Rob.
Here we go.
This is going to be awesome. Let you do this, honestly. So this is going to be interesting.
No, this is going to be great.
It is going to be great.
All right, so Christy, introduce yourself to the audience and let them know your background and your credentials and how you came to be into this role of this case.
Yeah, that might take a minute. So listeners obviously know that I'm Christy Barker. I am a career prosecutor, and it was pointed out to me recently it's 31 years that I have been doing prosecution work. It's all been felony work. And I don't know if I've mentioned before, I mean, within the first 6 months of my becoming a prosecutor, I prosecuted a murder successfully. And so that has always been like my goal in becoming a prosecutor was to prosecute murder cases. And so that is something I've always been very focused on. And I think anybody who does the work probably feels the same way. I have been almost exclusively in Savannah, Georgia, doing that work, and started in 1994. I retired from the Chatham County District Attorney's Office in December of 2019, but I continue to do some part-time work for that office. And then I did some full-time work and part-time work in the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit, and I'm still doing part-time work for them on a high-profile murder case for that office. So I'm continuing to do that work. You asked how I got involved in this case, the murder of Hakeem Clark, and I've got to give a little background on that too. So back when this case came up, we had a major case unit in the DA's office, and the major case unit used to staff cases, like basically homicide. And we'd really do it with any agency, but y'all were like the people who actually did it, like SPD homicide or SCMPD earlier on, would come over and say, "Hey, we've been working on this investigation for a while. We think we've got it. What do you think? Or we're missing something, you know, give us some direction. Or what kind of search warrants do you think we need?" Or something along those lines. Because I think we've talked about this before. You had people you consulted with, like Tom Cerbone, and you know, later it was Frank Pennington and Matt Braden and Isabel Polly, all of them at one point or another, and even before that, Greg Jacobs way back in the day, would consult with the violent crimes unit on these kinds of cases. But sometimes you just feel like, you know, you're in a rut or you're going in circles or something like that. So you'd bring stuff over. And I remember you brought two cases on the same day. And I remember sitting in the grand jury room and you did PowerPoint presentations and were better at it even then than I am now. And so you brought this case and you brought Timon Hooper. And I could feel the frustration for you because, you know, I think you were kind of feeling like, you know, I feel like we're pretty much there. I think Timon was a little shakier in your mind at that time. Am I right about that? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, because Hooper was just like such a circumstantial case at that point, and I believe it was just, like in Quaison's case, that we had seen evidence, although it was fucked up. But Hooper's was a little bit more circumstantial in my mind, and so I would agree.
Yeah, so I think part of it too with Hooper was there's always a worry when you're relying, and that case relied very heavily, especially in the early stages, on the statements of witnesses who might be reluctant to come to court. It's always a little bit easier when you're dealing with forensic evidence. Hey, I know my forensics officer will come to court. I know I can get Jenna Rojas and Michelle Shiro to come to court. So I remember sitting there and thinking, well, as between the two, I don't really want either one of them. But as between the two, this one on Quaison Lee, you got a fingerprint. That sounds pretty good. And of course, neither one of them got assigned to
Couple
me.
things on that before you go. Couple things on that before you go into it. So, first of all, Jenna made me sound like I'm a monster on the last podcast, and I just want to say I'm not a monster.
You're not a monster.
I had expectations for people to do their jobs, but that was it. And then, no, I know she was kidding, and
She was.
but. It's like, man, they really thought I was a monster, man. And then yeah, like it, typical Chris action, no case ever being good enough, right? Which always did impel me to do better in my investigations, but no case ever good enough. So yeah, I get that for sure. Yeah, you were, like we talked before, you were just kind of like, these cases suck. Like, these cases are shit. They're not ready.
I said it quite that way, but I might have. I tended, and that's probably fair. Like in the moment, you're gonna get that knee-jerk, very quick response from me, and then we'll talk about what my concerns actually are. Like I can be more specific, but like if
Yeah,
you
no,
just want
you're
like.
very specific. Yeah.
What kind of shit is on the shit towel, right?
Yeah, can't
So,
get anything off of it.
yeah, exactly. So, the fingerprint I felt was something that was far more reliable as evidence, but I was neither case got assigned to me. And I remember in that moment, I think Isabel was very excited about it. Isabel Pauline. Isabel's been on my show. Isabel, as you know, is a very enthusiastic prosecutor, and I think she felt like, particularly with Quaison, that it was a case that, basically, let's just do it. And I don't know if she did it right away, but I think the case got assigned to her and y'all developed it from there. And she indicted it originally. And when she indicted it, because I got it later, the indictment was not the way I would have done it. And I don't want to fault her for that because you feel like, oh, anything I say is going to sound super critical. And of course, much like you, I think I get characterized as a monster frequently. And I'm not saying I'm not, I just would prefer not to be characterized that way.
Well, let's be honest. If you're prosecuting murders, you want to be a monster, man. Like that's why, like you want to be that way. Like you want to be like high expectations, doing it right. Nothing's getting in my way. Like that. As much as we say we're not monsters, I guess we kind of are.
And the truth of it is, like in many circumstances, I have taken over like a murder case file, and I don't automatically reindict something, even if it's not an indictment that I would do a specific way. And this case, so she had indicted it, and there was a murder count. There were some armed robbery counts, there were some gang counts, but it wasn't like what I ended up doing when I reindicted it was like murder and then a gang count attached to it and firearm part counts attached to it, and then, you know, felony murder, and, you know, having those, all of those counts attached to it, because I don't want the jury to compromise and then we lose a count altogether, right? Like, I want to make sure that every count has it. And so, and the armed robbery counts, there, I think there was one that was missing, and I wanted an attempted armed robbery on Hakeem, and, you know, those kinds of things. So I when I went back and did it that way, it made more sense to me. It was easier. But I also added the Amantha Lott armed robbery that we've talked about before, because that wasn't on there at all. And we were right up against the statute of limitations on that Amantha Lott armed robbery, and, you know, had to reindict it like immediately to get that in, because we were like 2 weeks away when I took over the case. So, or when I actually started looking at it. So to clarify why it was I ended up with this case is that Isabel left the DA's office and she took a federal job and moved out of town. So this case and Timone Hooper and
Rebecca Foley.
Yeah, Foley Pastures, all of those ended up on my desk. And I was like, but thank God, you know, Rob's involved in all these cases, because if not, I don't know what would have happened. But actually, Quezon was probably the last of the three that I actually spent serious time looking at. And it may be, if I remember right, the firearm case on him was coming up for a motion to suppress. And that's why I started really looking at the file. So
I don't think we talked about that yet.
We did. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'll just touch on it quick and then I'll let you keep going, because I like what you're saying. But so when Quezon Lee, we talked about some of his prior arrests, he was arrested on an unrelated firearms and gun case, or a firearms and drug case, in 2017, in Daffin Park, and it was unrelated to the murder, but he had been arrested in middle of 2017. I want to say it was August or July or something. And he was in jail for that case. And so then in early 2018 was when the first indictment with Isabel was done. And so he was in jail. Then he got indicted for the murder. So specifically the motion that you're talking about is related to the firearms and drug case, which I believe Isabel, when she indicted it, she did indict that case along with the murder, because it's a gang case. And it's kind of what we talked about in the last episode, where it's related in that it's gang activity or OTF, and these were OTF members in Daffin Park and so on and so forth. I'm not going to go into like the details of it more than that, and I'll let you kind of keep going, but that's the motion that you were talking about.
Right. So, he was in a vehicle and we had this motion to suppress coming up, and I probably even sent you a subpoena before I started looking at the file. But I remember looking at it going, I really need to look at this murder and look at the indictment and everything else. I think they actually were indicted separately. But regardless, because I know that the motion to suppress was handled separately.
Did they eventually get merged?
I don't think so.
Or no. I thought they were, but I could be wrong.
Right. So I'm trying to look at like the records from the clerk's office in Chatham County, and it's really hard to tell. Those charges have disappeared. I mean, it's almost like, you know, they may have just dismissed them and allowed those to be sealed. So I am not even able to find them on the clerk's office website. So it's really kind of strange, because it's not part of the case that Isabel had, her indictment. Her indictment was the 2018 okay. indictment. So it's not on there. It's just weird. So in any case, I started looking at that murder indictment and I wanted to reindict. And I don't want to throw shade at Isabel. You know full well, like, I respect the hell out of her. She's somebody who's like someone I consider to be a really excellent lawyer, and she can try the hell out of the case. In this period of time, like right up in the lead up before she left, there was a stretch in there where I think she tried 4 murders in 6 weeks or something. It was like something insane. Like, she was trying stuff back to back, and you get more cases and indicting more cases. And so any imperfection in the indictment, I can excuse, you know, based on, hey, you know, she's, you know, really been working her behind off. And I knew she had been. That said, when I got the file, I was like, shit, there's stuff missing in here, and it doesn't, you know, missing in the indictment. And I need to put this in some kind of order. And so I went to reindict the case and add Amantha Lotz armed robbery. And I figured once we get started, I'm just going to add all of the gang charges for everything, because it all related. And you had shown me at that point all of the audio and the pictures and everything else from the social media that we've talked about. And I was thinking, this is great. We've got it. And I'm sure you were surprised to hear me say that. but we needed to get it indicted. And what I had not realized, this case was assigned to Judge Morse, just as Timon Hooper was. And both cases were on a docket. It might have been a trial docket call or something along those lines. But there was a case on there that Maggie DeLeon had that was going to trial, and she went to nolpros the old indictment in favor of the new indictment, which, you know, for superseding indictments, that's the law. The prosecutor has the ability to do that. And Judge Morse,
can you explain that a little bit to, like, people that might not know? Because it's not really, like, intuitive. I don't think you kind of have to explain how it goes.
Yeah, I can try to. I mean, unfortunately, these technical legal things are never going to feel intuitive to anybody other than lawyers. But it can make sense. So if I recharge something as a prosecutor, if I take a case back to grand jury and I indict it for basically the same charges, but configured differently, which is what happened here. And even if, like, say I look at it and I add charges, the prosecution can do that. Like, when you look at a case and you prepare it for trial and you realize, oh, wow, I forgot this firearm charge, or I forgot gang charges, or, you know, we need to have armed robbery charges for everybody. It's not a vindictive thing to do. It is something that actually you should be doing as a lawyer. Is you should be looking at your case file and saying, hey, I need to make sure that my indictment is in order. Because what the jury is going to be told about how to proceed on and decide what this person has done is based on your indictment. So if you have,
yeah, it's super important. Like, if you have, like, wrong dates or a wrong charge or whatever, right?
Right. And you got the right names in there, you know, those kinds of things. And sometimes there are errors in there. I mean, sometimes, like, it's a typo. Sometimes, you know, like, for whatever reason, you deleted, like, the date or something. I mean, crazy things happen. So there are 1,000 reasons to draft a new indictment and reindict a case. Sometimes, like, you get DNA back and you want to indict somebody for another charge that the DNA reveals or something. There are a lot of reasons to do it. The law, and it is even U.S. Supreme Court law, says the prosecutor can do that. And the prosecutor, and that's the term that's used, is called a superseding indictment. In other words, you have not dismissed the old indictment, but you're proceeding on the new indictment. So it's a superseding indictment. It takes over for the last one. And prosecutors can do that. I don't have to even dismiss the old one. I personally like to do that, so it's clear to me, it's clear to everybody, and there's no confusion. But some people don't. And I know, like, Frank Pennington, I know back in the day, he liked to hold on to the old indictment in case there was a challenge to the new indictment that he lost, maybe, you know, based on whatever. And I think there's just always that anxiety, particularly with things like the statute of limitations. Like I mentioned with Amantha a lot, there is a 4-year statute of limitations on armed robbery. So from the time we knew that she was a victim and she reported it day of, so the state knew about that charge, but the state did not, you know, bring an indictment on it. We have to do it within 4 years. And so I needed to get that case indicted. I needed to get those charges indicted. That statute of limitations issue, let's say we were 4 years down the road and we still hadn't tried the case yet. You'd be anxious about dismissing the old indictment in favor of the new indictment in case somebody is going to claim, oh, you indicted it outside the statute of limitations, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So, and that's always something that prosecutors have in the back of their mind too. Like, keep the old one in my back pocket just in case. So
it's the kind of posture that's the posture that this case was in, and also this one that you're talking about with Maggie.
Right, right. So Maggie's case was a rape. She had re-indicted it, and Judge Morris would not allow her to dismiss the old indictment. He wouldn't accept the null pros. He wouldn't accept the document dismissing the old indictment and proceeding on the new indictment. And so she had to go to trial on an old indictment that I can't remember the flaw in it, but there was a flaw in the old indictment. It might've been a date. I don't remember. But she ended up getting a conviction on lesser charges on that case. And some of that was due to the failure of allowing her to proceed on the superseding indictment because it complicated unnecessarily the trial of the case. And of course, she had prepared to try the case on the new indictment. And in the moment, she didn't have like the battery of case law that, you know, I can say you should, but you really shouldn't. The judge should know. Like, the judge should know the law and should understand, yeah, like, you know, this is something that prosecutors have the authority to do. But because that had happened, we were in a weird situation because I was tendering dismissals to the court. And you'll remember this because it was the same day that we had the motion to suppress on the firearm case. You were in court for that.
Yep.
And I went to tender the dismissal of the old indictment on the murder. And the defense attorney on this case was James Byrne. And you actually heard him say it. I didn't hear him say
it. Yeah.
What did he say?
He kind of leaned over to Quezon and he's like, watch this. And then he objects to the dismissal of the first indictment, basically based off the precedent from Maggie's case. Well, I say precedent, not in the traditional term, but like in Morse's courtroom so he basically objected to the dismissal of the first indictment and the proceeding under the superseding indictment. So under the second indictment. So he was saying that we had to keep Isabel's indictment, not use yours.
Right.
And I think the same thing was done in the Timon Hooper case, too.
It was. And I remember I stood up and I said, Judge, can I be heard on this? And he said, not at this time.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it. And it wasn't the end of it because I then filed, as I am apt to do, lengthy briefs on both of them.
Yeah.
Which, you know, after reading my briefs, he was like, okay, fine, I'll let you dismiss the old indictments. But in the context of this, James Byrne was also representing Timon Hooper. There were a series of things in that case and in this one prior to the actual null pros or dismissal of those old indictments that led to a motion to recuse the judge. All of which were interrelated with what we've already talked about, the expression by the court that basically he's taking it out on the prosecution, that he's unhappy with how things have been going in the office, so he's just not going to honor like what the law requires. So that caused a lengthy delay for both cases. And
And that was in 2018.
Yeah, 2018. Well, 2019 is when we tried Timon. So yeah, no, it would have been 2019,
Yeah,
early.
but it was, yeah.
Yeah, it
Yeah,
would have
so
been.
that so this was sort of already 4 years after pretty much the murder.
Right. So this is like January 2019 is when we reindicted Quezon, and then we had court. We were cranking up on Timon, you and I had been going to federal prisons and interviewing people and all this stuff, because that had gotten more publicity. It was a higher profile case.
Well, we also had the what you call it, like the what do you call it? You only have so much time before you can prosecute them, like when
Right.
they're in
So
federal custody.
right, because he was in federal custody and the detainer had been put, we thought the detainer had been put on. That turned out not to be true. Well done, Frank. Frank got it right. But we thought there had been a detainer put on him. And because of that, he had to be tried within 6 or 9 months of the detainer being filed. No one could find the detainer, by the way. So, like, I'm running around trying to find all this stuff. It was a mess. Bottom line is, like, I get these two cases, and like the procedural disasters involved had me a little stressed out and a little too much monster going on. But I ended up filing a motion to recuse both on Timon Hooper and on Quezon Lee based on the court not allowing me to dismiss the old indictments. That delayed things by probably 2 months. I think we talked about it in the context of Timon Hooper, because of
Yeah.
course it's more detailed in that context. But the bottom line was, the court had basically said, I'm going to let the defense do whatever they want because I'm pissed off with the prosecution. And I had and like there was this idea that, well, I have to let them be incompetent or do whatever they feel like doing. And I guess there was this need to flex on somebody, so it was going to be me. And I wasn't having it. So the motion to recuse eventually was denied, and we tried to appeal that. That d appeal was also denied. And so both cases kind of got back on track. We ended up trying Timon Hooper in August of that year. And Quezon Lee was in the queue, basically. He was in the queue to be tried. Probably, they were looking at January, maybe. Because again, one of the other technical things that was going on at that time is that the judges would shift, like all of their cases would go to another judge. There was a rotation. Someone else was coming into that, I think it was a J1 or J2 slot. And it was going to be Judge Walmsley taking over in January. And so this case was going to be in front of Judge Walmsley after the first of the year. And then I decided to retire. Which had there were a lot of reasons for that. And I retired end of December. Jillian Gibson took over my slot, and Jillian had been in the office. She was starting that January. And I gave her external hard drive with all my stuff on it. I told her I was, willing to help if she needed anything. And my intention actually had been, if the office had asked me to, I would probably have come back and tried that case. I would certainly have tried Kevin Smith, had I been asked. Kevin Smith being involved in Foley Pastures, because we were going to have to try him again. And I was still doing appeals and motions for new trial and, all of the things on the cases that I had tried. I was still doing that on a part-time basis. But Jillian took over the case file. And I remember she reached out to me, and I can't remember exactly when it was, but she could not find the electronic evidence. So she couldn't find, and I told her it was on, and I showed her the external hard drive. It's on here. And she seemed rather frustrated with me at the time. I wasn't sure exactly why. I don't know if you had issues with that. Like, did you, I know you.
Well, what I can say is that once you retired, it was pretty much radio silence from the DA's office on this case for me, other than like my own self-initiated like check-ins and stuff of like, hey, well, what the fuck's going on with this?
But you
so,
were gone.
Like, I didn't even know. No, I was still there. I was there.
That's what I don't understand. I mean, that's the thing, like, I really don't understand. I mean, it's not like you were unavailable.
No, I was available. So like, yeah, I think, you know, I didn't even know about like the lost hard drive or anything like that. So yeah, I didn't know any about any of that stuff until later. You know, I think you told me some of that stuff, but
well, people kept reaching
yeah,
out
then,
to me. Like she reached out to me about where is it, and you know, she had the external hard drive. I'm like, it's on there. I don't have it.
I think you also had told her like, talk to Santoro. He can show you exactly where the shit is.
Right, because
I
will say this till my dying day. You know, I'm not very technically adept, but the how to find the voice messages on the basically Facebook dump that we got was not intuitive in any way to me.
No, it wasn't.
And I knew that there were things that would have to be done to allow her to listen to those, and that you could explain it, and or if absolutely necessary, that Matt Breeden could. And so I advised her to help, to you know, reach out to you, reach out to him. But she reached out to me a couple of times. Like, you left. When did you leave?
I left in the end of March of 2020.
Okay, so you left, but Matt was still there until the end of 2020.
Well, Matt was still there, but I was also still, like, I communicated with, I came back for trials, like I came back for the Jose Carrillo trial. There was communication between the DA's office and me about like ongoing cases and things like that. I think I did meet with Jillian maybe once or twice just to talk about things, but it was very general. And then at one point she went on maternity leave when in this case was scheduled for a trial, so it got continued again for that. And then it got and then COVID happened.
Yeah. I mean, it was 2020. So yeah, COVID happened end of March. I mean, basically, you know, that whole big delay pushed everything into 2021. 2021 comes around, and I can see, and I know this is true, that there was a motion to exclude gang evidence in this case. And I knew it was coming because James Byrne was always like, oh, yeah, he was accusing me of vindictiveness and re-indicting the case, because I did add a bunch of charges. I did, because I like my indictments to be a certain way. Like, I like to have the murder, I like to have the felony murder based on, you know, armed robbery or attempted armed robbery or aggravated assault. And each of those has a collection of charges that go with it in this case, because there are the gang charges that are associated, the firearm charges that are associated with it. And so it looks like it's a whole lot of stuff you've added, but it really isn't, because you know, it's just like clumps of things that should have been there, in my opinion, to begin with. But he was complaining about it, and so he was trying to make out that the gang charges were vindictive as well. But he had filed a motion to exclude the gang evidence. I can see that Jillian filed a response to it, and it's a good response. It is familiar to me. I've seen that response. Matt, I know, has filed something similar in many cases, and you know, references to like, oh, you can't get into his juvenile history. Well, I mean, he was a juvenile when he committed this murder, so you know, that's not complicated. So yeah, I mean, it's a good response. It looks like that was denied, but I will say this. I mean, at least, you know, Jillian, I know, was concerned about trying a gang case. I don't think she had tried a gang case before. And I know she did reach out to me at some point. I told her, talk to Matt. Because, you know, if you're going to consult with somebody who does gang prosecutions. Matt teaches on it, like with the prosecuting attorney's counsel. He's tried more gang cases probably than anybody in that office. He's probably the person you need to talk to about, you know, just how to put it together. And you had everything. I mean, that's my opinion, but you know, it's not my opinion. It's a fact because it's all there. I mean, it's all there. So I was really frustrated, I guess, at a distance, and I probably didn't have complete information, so I don't want to be unfair to her. But I don't know that she had tried a gang case before, and I think she was very anxious about that. That anxiety seems to be something that office has really indulged since then. And I want to comment on it because it's something that, as someone who is now outside of it, is infuriating. When you see a case, and I'm using as an example here, Arthur Newton, which was a capital case, multiple co-defendants, very clearly a gang-related crime. You were involved in the prosecution of the armed robbery that led to this murder that Arthur Newton and his friends committed. A lot of the gang evidence, well, not a lot of it, some of the gang evidence, because they were Bloods, was presented in that case. And it directly related to Arthur Newton. So Antoine Drayton went to trial on armed robbery. Matt tried that case. You testified in it as a gang expert. And it was all laid out. It's in the transcript. This is not, you know, all you really have to do is follow the bouncing ball, right? When Arthur Newton's case came up, and there were, again, four co-defendants, they pled out three of them. Two of them got, in my opinion, just slaps on the wrist. It was embarrassing, the sentences that they got. The shooter did get a life sentence, but it was life with the possibility of parole. And that was all of them. There was gang evidence that they were going to be given houses for committing this crime. They were going to be upped in rank.
So Arthur Newton got life with the possibility of parole?
No, I'm talking about Timothy, what's his name, the shooter. Because Newton was in. He was in jail. Pardon me?
Coleman.
Yeah, Timothy Coleman.
But, yeah.
He got life with the possibility of parole.
Coleman got life with the possibility of parole.
Yes, correct. And the other two, like, they null processed, like, all the gang charges. I could go on and on. I'm not going to go on and on. Because it's infuriating. But none of the gang charges. When Arthur Newton went to trial, and he did go to trial, when Arthur Newton went to trial, they did not present the gang evidence. They put up Timothy Coleman as a witness, which I would never have done. I could go on and on, but there were a lot of things. I mean, they got a conviction, fine. But this was a gang hit that was ordered from the Chatham County Detention Center. And he was not held accountable for all the crimes he committed. And in part because they just didn't know how to present the gang evidence. That happened again recently in that trial of Kevin Smith. Again, you know, you've got a transcript of this is a gang murder. And all of the gang evidence was put in. There was no reason that trial ended up being sterilized because they didn't want to talk about the gang evidence because I guess they don't know how.
As an investigator, like, that shit pisses me off because I was part of those investigations, right? And like, just like in this one, to get enough evidence on a gang right, for criminal charges. Like, that takes a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it's not easy. And you're convincing people that are scared and don't want to talk to you to give you information about a group that is violent. And many of these groups, just like, you know, Arthur Newton's group, like, they will retaliate and shoot people and kill people that talk to you as witnesses and things like this. So, like, it's not a small thing. And so, like, it pisses me off on two levels. Number one, you know, on behalf of the people that are witnesses in those types of cases, because that's just, we're failing to protect them. And then the other part of it is just the immense amount of work. And if there's a reason, right? Like, if there's a reason why that happens, like, I could understand that. But to just, like, in those examples you provided, there's not a good reason for that.
No, I mean, like I said, it's already laid out for you. It's already laid out for you. I mean, there is a transcript. Clearly, the evidence has been already tendered to the court. It is not a complicated thing to just basically read along with it. And for whatever reason, they've made these decisions not to. And I don't think that they are capable of handling a gang case. And I think the reality is that they are, I guess, now calling in the Attorney General's gang unit to help try stuff, but you can't really do that. You've got to have boots on the ground with this, and they just aren't doing the work. And that's, considering how much a lot of those prosecutors are getting paid, that's pretty embarrassing. So my opinion, I think I've earned the right to give it. In any case, in this case, Quezon Lee, Jillian didn't try it, because Jillian left the office, left the DA's office, and she is now in the Ogeechee Circuit as a chief assistant. And so Jillian leaves the office, and I don't even know how many prosecutors touched this case after that. So that she left at, I think, the end of 2021. And so that case bounced around for like 2 years. The defense,
and I don't even know for a while if it was even assigned. Again, I don't have access to their system to know official assignments, but I want to say, like, I was asking who had the case, and it just, there was just, like, again, just nobody was communicating. Brian DeBlasis did communicate with me a little bit, and eventually, you know, I'll let you go into that, but yeah, it was, I would not be shocked if it wasn't even assigned for a time there.
I wouldn't either. And quite honestly, I think that has been a complaint that I've heard from a number of people. Like, they'll contact the office. It's like, oh, that case is not assigned yet. Because they don't have prosecutors. They have people leaving pretty much constantly. I mean, I'm hearing that Brian DeBlasis is leaving. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't have confidence that they have bodies at all, like, to actually try cases, let alone bodies that are competent to try the kinds of cases that you get in Savannah, Georgia. So the case eventually gets assigned to someone named Gabriel Justice, who I've never met. And, you know, I can only go by what I'm seeing in the file. But James Byrne, obviously, once again, was doing a, hey, y'all watch this, because he filed a constitutional speedy trial demand on this case. And, you know, honestly, for good reason. The case had been sitting for a while, and, you know, combination of COVID, not having a prosecutor, all of those things. This guy's been sitting in jail awaiting trial, right? And that is always a problem for any prosecutor at any time. So, you know, we've got to own that. In this circumstance, Judge Walmsley denied the constitutional speedy. They tried to appeal it. They tried to do it as an interlocutory appeal. The Georgia Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, because it bounced, like, part of it got assigned to one, part of it got assigned to another. And I think that actually that split was, like, they did it on both the murder and on the firearm case. But the firearm case is, like I said, I think it's just been obliterated from the record. So For whatever reason, the DA's
So
office
when
must
you
have
say
reason.
the speedy trial thing, what you're saying is like basically he filed to get the case dismissed because he's been sitting in jail and has and basically violated his constitutional rights to a trial in a
Speedy
timely
trial.
manner. Is that correct?
Correct. So it's a Sixth Amendment right to be to a speedy trial. And, you know, if there have been delays, the delays, if they are attributable to the state, are, you know, things that can cause a case to be dismissed, basically like for want of prosecution. And I mean, it's not exactly for want of prosecution, but what it is effectively the same. So the defendant is prejudiced by sitting in jail, awaiting trial, not getting his trial in a timely manner. And certainly, you know, there, you know, on its face, he'd been sitting in jail for a long time. So that got, the appeals got dismissed. It came back to the trial court, and then they decided to plead him, plead Quezon Lee. Now, I don't know, like, you probably should have had some information about that, I would think. Did they talk to you about this?
I'm going to comment on this real quick. So, yes and no. So I want to say it was around the time that the appeal was still pending on the Sixth Amendment motion or whatever. Gabriel Justice had sent me an email basically saying like that there were some weaknesses in the case and that, you know, they were thinking about pleading him and, you know, dismissing the armed robbery. I think he had that in his email. I'm not quoting it verbatim because I just remember getting like white hot pissed and I fired something back to him in writing to say like, I wholeheartedly disagree with your assessment of the strength of this case. And I will not support a plea in this case. I would rather go to trial and lose. And you know, basically I told him like, I disagree with you 100% on your assessment of what this case is and its viability in trial. And I would the only way I would be as if Hakeem's parents said that that's what they wanted.
So,
and so
and
then
I'm
at
sorry,
one point, Brian DeBlasis had told me one point, Brian DeBlasis told me that they would not plea the case or anything like that without, telling me or having a conversation with me. And that was the last I heard. And so as far as I knew, they weren't going to plead it. And I found out that he pled, I want to say, when you sent me a link of his new arrest. I was like, well, how the fuck is he out? And so the only benefit of the doubt I'm going to give them there is that I changed positions briefly here in Minnesota and my work cell phone number changed. But two things, my email address never changed. And that's how they contacted me the first time. And then also, like at that time, I think Puhala was still there and Sammons is there. Like they know how to fucking get a hold of me. So my email address was still there. My fucking phone numbers work. If they needed a new number, they could have just asked for it. But no, so I was never notified of it getting pled.
So I'm looking at this, the remitter, in other words, when the case came back from the appellate courts was 2023. And the plea was not until August of 2024. So yeah, and November of 23 is when the remitter came back from the appellate courts, and the plea was on, I believe, August. Let me look at this because I'm not trying to like take anything out of context. August 19th of 2024. So it's been a year. And so I heard about it I can't remember when I heard about it. It's the kind of thing where you hear things through the grapevine that they were pleading it. I think I
Everybody,
hear.
what the plea was to.
All right, so yeah, let me talk about that for a second. So they dismissed the indictment that I had drafted, that had gone to grand jury. They dismissed that. They dismissed the firearm case, because that's part of this too, is the 2017 firearm case gets dismissed as well. And they replaced that. They had their own, they did it in an accusation to voluntary manslaughter. Voluntary manslaughter and criminal attempt to commit armed robbery. That those are the two charges that were left for.
Criminal attempt to actually get their fucking property.
Yeah, so I kind of want to
I
read
guess
through.
they're not even counting the other victims, like the other fucking friends. I guess they don't exist. This is just Hakeem, right? Because they didn't get anything from him.
Right, so I want to read you the factual basis from the transcript, because I feel like it's so sanitized, it's wild. So what this says, Mr. Justice, this is what he told the court is the basis for the play in this case. On July 25th, 2015, police responded to a post office on Palm Street in Savannah, Georgia for a shooting. When they arrived, they discovered the victim, Hakeem Clark, suffering from a gunshot wound and seated in a vehicle at the scene. Based on the testimony of eyewitnesses, Mr. Clark and his friends had traveled from out of town to visit Savannah and were meeting one another at the post office. While there, they were approached by two unknown black males wearing masks who demanded money. One of the two men carried a pistol. Some of Mr. Clark's friends were able to escape by running, and they are ultimately who called for help. But Clark himself was shot, and his remaining friends were robbed. Video surveillance of the incident corroborated the general narrative of the assault, but was inadequate to enable a satisfactory identification of the shooters. Mr. Clark tragically succumbed to his wounds after being transported for medical treatment. Subsequent investigation led police to discover a fingerprint left on the door of Clark's car by the defendant. This fingerprint was matched to Mr. Quezon Lee. His was the only fingerprint that was not attributable to the victim or one of his friends. I don't know where they came up with that. This, combined with the defendant's alibi, which was at odds with other evidence in the case, and evidence on the defendant's cell phone, led to his identification as one of the two assailants on that night. As a result of this conduct, the defendant was charged as follows. As the court indicated, this case that is before the court is the latest of a number of indictments, but the current indictment before this court is count one, voluntary manslaughter. The sentencing range for that is from 1 to 20 years. In exchange for his guilty plea, he'll receive a 20-year sentence, 7 of which to serve and 13 probated. Count two is criminal attempt to commit a felony, that felony being armed robbery, because the maximum sentence of that armed robbery charge is life. The attempt minimum in this and maximum range is from 1 to 30 years. In exchange for his guilty plea, he will receive a 10-year probated sentence, which will run consecutively to count one. This is part of what he says too. The defendant has no felony history and there is no recidivist enhancement. For a total sentence then of 30 years, with the first 7 years to be served in confinement and that time having been served, and he'll receive credit for the time served as determined by the custodian, the remainder of his sentence will be served on probation. This is all now the conditions of probation. This is like astounding how little there is here. While on probation, he will pay a probation supervision fee. His application fee and attorney's fees are being waived. The special conditions of his plea include that he'll report to the Department of Community Service as instructed, that he will waive his Fourth Amendment rights, he will submit to specimen admissibility, including waiving the evidentiary foundation for admissibility of any lab results. He'll submit to a records release. He will not possess or transport ammunition and waives his right to challenge extradition if arrested in another jurisdiction. The total potential sentence he could have received as charged in this indictment, considering his consecutive sentencing, would be 50 years. And that's what he pled to. He asked for first offender, and to his credit, Judge Walmsley did not give it. But yeah, he got 30 years, 7 to serve, probation in the
Out
simple.
that day.
Yeah, out that day, but no like responsibility to do anything, like no community service, no no affirmative anything that would mean that the Department of Community Supervision will actually keep their eye on him. Because what actually happens, and you know, this is just for listeners, for probation to actually keep an eye on people, they don't do it. Essentially, what's happening now is they can call in and say, hey, I'm reporting, and leave a message. So, you know, at this point, he has to do absolutely nothing. This is someone who killed somebody. Yep. And robbed people and killed someone in front of his friends. So, to his credit, and I will say this, they did read the victim impact statement, but didn't read it until after sentence was imposed. I mean, it's bizarre the way this is set up. And I'm not going to read all of it. Hakeem's mom had submitted a victim impact statement. Now, when she submitted this, whether or not they agreed to this as a plea, you and I are never going to know. Never.
Well, I just think, like, imagine as their family, like, you know, we've been talking about this on this podcast with some emotion and stuff, but, like, imagine being the family just getting fucking dicked around by the system the way that they did, between the fucking shuffling lawyers and appeals and continuances and all this bullshit. And I mean, you're talking fucking almost 10 years since their son was killed.
Yeah. And you know,
15,
at this point,
20,
they just
24, 9 years.
Right. And at this point, you're just so beaten down and you don't think anything's going to happen, that something is better than nothing. But I, you know, and I saw it, like, I was there when Timothy Coleman pled, and you have this victim's family that is just so shattered and beaten down, and you know, that they basically will say anything at that point. They don't even know what to make of what's happening. But this is part of her statement to the court. Dear Judge Walmsley, I'm the mother of Hakeem Clark. He was my baby and my best friend. He was taken way too soon from his family at the age of 26 years old. Our family will always remember July 25th, 2015, just past 11 p.m. and receiving a phone call. Get to the hospital. Hakeem has been injured. Hakeem was the baby of the family to two other siblings. Hakeem had a great sense of humor, an affectionate smile that you could spot a mile away. He touched so many lives, or whomever might cross his path could testify that he was as genuine and caring a young man. He was always well-dressed and handsome, I might add. He had a heart of gold. Hakeem would always put others before himself. He was a church-going young man. He ran track, played football, and received numerous accolades. His family, teachers, friends, and coworkers loved him to the moon and back because he would give 100-plus some toward everything he did. She also, toward the end, she mentions it. She talks about his work, and she's like, I could go on and on about my son. Our life has been like a roller coaster of many twists, turns, hills, and mountains. To say the least, I've developed health issues, and I'm in therapy once a week. I've developed major trust issues. My husband puts all his energy toward his job. Some days we live like roommates, wondering what we could have done differently. Why couldn't this just be a bad dream? When you lose a child to murder, the impact is devastating. And I do remember meeting Barbara Clark. You introduced me. And I remember at the time thinking, I've got to make this right for her. And this isn't right. This isn't right. And what's worse is that this isn't the end of violence from Quezon Lee. So when I found out that he pled, I'm thinking it might have been September last year. I can't remember. I cannot remember exactly when. I know it was significantly after the plea had happened. And I might have not learned about it until the arrest for the firearm shooting charge. So since then, so this plea happens October 19th of 2024. He gets out. He's on probation in whatever vague way we might call this probation. Subsequent to that, and I'm just going from filed in indictments at this point, He's charged with the commission of a shooting, an aggravated assault, that according to the indictment, he and another individual on October 15th, so not even 2 months, not even 2 months, October 15th, 2024, did make an assault upon the person of Ronald DeFeesile with a deadly weapon, a handgun, by shooting at him. So it's not like he just kind of pointed a pistol at him or scared him with a gun. No, he shot at him. There's also a criminal damage to property in the second degree charge with this, by shooting his vehicle, his black Ford F-150, without his consent, shooting at the truck with bullets, hitting several areas along the passenger side of the vehicle. There are firearm charges. They did not include and should have a 1611-133 charge, which, again, I'm talking legal jargon, but 1611-133 is a special enhancement for the possession of a firearm by someone who has committed a prior violent felony. So it is an automatic 15 years consecutive if you get a conviction on that charge. And because he has a prior violent felony, which involved a firearm use, that being the voluntary manslaughter, would be an automatic 15 years to serve consecutive. But
they didn't do that.
They didn't do that. No, of course not. Because why would we expect that to be something that they do in this DA's office? But interestingly, so that aggravated assault occurred. The aggravated assault was not indicted until May of this year. Apparently, he did not get arrested. It's the same sort of thing that we've seen with him before. He got arrested in December of 2024. For possession of a firearm by convicted felon and obstruction of an officer on December the 11th of 2024. He had a Glock on him that time. And again, they don't do the 1611-133, but whatever. And you probably couldn't in that case because there's not a shooting. But he got stopped, I guess, in the same circumstances, much like, you know, your situation where he had a firearm at the park. I think, I don't know whether this is a park or not. But he gets stopped in December, and I guess they must have put it together that he was the person who was involved in the October shooting. But this accusation was filed in February of this year, and the indictment on the aggravated assault did not come until May. But yeah, he's got two firearm-related charges happening within 4 months of his release for killing somebody in a gang-related shooting. And we'll never know if these other shootings are gang-related because they don't know how to prosecute them.
Well, and that's also just the ones he got caught on. Imagine all the ones that they didn't investigate, you know, like.
Right. I mean, do we have his phone? Did we look at his social media? I mean, we know he's done it before. Did they even bother?
Yeah, it's crazy, man.
But you wonder why our community doesn't feel safe. Guess what? This is exactly why. Because we have people that are just getting out. And again, you know, we have people kind of revolving door on that are probably gang members. That probably happens all the time. I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. But when you have someone who's killed somebody, and they're out shooting people some more, I don't have words for that. It is my
understanding. Well, what you need, and I'm going to brag on you here for a second because you've bragged on me a whole bunch on this podcast, but what you need is more prosecutors like you, just for reasons that just within this last 5 minutes, like, you know, you know about the enhancements, like, you know about the law. You know, we kind of joked about it, but like you're a super detail oriented prosecutor. So like you go through the files, you know them well, and like you know what the fuck you're doing. Like you've had some big cases, like you had Jennifer Ross, like you either were lead or helped with, like, you know, Amber DeLoach, you know, Timon. This case, Rebecca Foley and James Pastures, like there are a lot of cases that and I'm not even touching the surface probably on all the ones that you were part of or led as a prosecutor, but I mean, you taught me a lot, and I know we like go back and forth on like, oh yeah, you said my case was shit and whatever, but like it's because you want the best case possible and you know how to execute in the courtroom and like you work your ass off, and that's what you need in a DA's office is people like you. And I appreciate you. I know you beat yourself up on a couple cases that we had, this being one of them that, you know, we didn't get to see through the finish line, but this isn't on you either, Christy. So
It feels like it is. I mean, and truly, I've spoken to Jillian, or I've been in touch with her, and she said that she had listened to some of the earlier episodes about this, and she feels the same way, like somehow that we've failed. And I certainly feel that way with this, because, and it's not just failing Hakeem and his family and his friends. I mean, that failure exists certainly. But now it is so obvious that it is a failure for the community. And I don't know how people involved in the decisions that led to this sleep at night. You know, I mean, I do. I kick myself for cases that we've had. There's no question about that. And, you know, I'll be 100% honest. Like, I was on the fence about Shanika Dunbar. You know this. And you like
yeah.
cussed me out for it. I deserved it. But you know, the facts are the facts, right? And again, you talk about you know what you're doing, you definitely do. And when you say I'm not okay with you like pleading this down to nothing without talking to me, that is an opinion that has value.
Yeah, I have no doubt that, like, if I ever said that to you, like, there's no way you would have pled it. If I was like, hey, there's no fucking way we're pleading this, like, you know, like there's no way. And we've talked, like, there's some cases where that maybe that is appropriate, right? Or maybe that's like, you know, I don't want to call it justice, because maybe like Manigault, it's not, it's like in that case I was more open to that because of a full understanding of like the case and where it stood and the just the facts of it and everything. Like there's certain situations where, like, you know, it's tenable, right? Like, and you know, for the people out there that don't know the voluntary manslaughter statute, that's typically, just in layman's terms, that's kind of like the domestic violence statute, where like it's a fit of passion. So like if you come home and your spouse is cheating in bed with somebody and you kill that person or you kill her, it's like the fit of passion. Like that's sort of what that statute is geared towards, not a masked up armed robbery where you shoot somebody and take their shit. Like there's no fit of pat, like it doesn't even fit the statute in my mind. Like
No.
it so like where, like as we talked about before a man ago, like there's maybe that argument that could have been made where like, all right, like he gets pissed, right? He just gets angry and he just gets angry, or he's defending himself, right? Like there were that
Right.
was real. So like
Right.
I don't know, but like my point is that you would have listened to me, and like those relationships do matter. And I think an office that doesn't value that, or a prosecutor that doesn't value that, you're not doing it right. You're not fucking doing your job right. And I would say that on the police side too. Like if you're just like, oh fuck the prosecutors and I'll just do my own thing, my case is enough, and I'm just gonna charge it no matter what they say, like that you're fucking doing your job wrong.
And that I, you know, that relationship, and it's something that, you know, we've been trying to put into words, I think, every podcast episode that we've ever done, every podcast episode I've done for Inside the Bar. And I think that, you know, anytime I speak on this issue, it is not like meant to be a lecture. It is meant to bring to light how important it is to actually listen to people and to care.
Yeah.
And I know you do. I do too. And I don't, I'm not going to be okay with Quezon Lee if he walks on this. I'm not, you know, if they plead him out to nothing. I mean, and again, we've had situations too, and you are well aware of them. Like, you go to trial, sometimes you roll the dice and the jury lets them go. That's on the jury. You know, it's a jury of your peers. I'm still not saying that I would be okay with that in like a case like this, but it happens.
You gave the system a chance to work, though. You know, like, right. That's the point. Like, you give the fucking system a chance to work, and the outcome be what it is. Like,
right.
You do a bullshit plea and let the guy out. Like, you're not letting the system try to work. Like, you're just shitting all over it.
Well, and you're not even trying. I mean, this is a case that, like, with really not huge effort, you can get a conviction, at least on the murder. I mean, like, the gang charges, and again, the gang evidence is definitely there, but it is more work to present. I understand that. And it is more complicated. You know, you have to know how to express that to a jury, but the evidence is there, and you can do it. It's not hard, especially, like, even if you've never done it before, if you've got a transcript in front of you, how hard is this, right?
Yeah, you put it together. And to that point, though, like, yeah, it's a lot of work to fucking prove it up as an investigator, too. But it doesn't mean you don't fucking do it. Like, do your fucking job, man. Like, it's your job. Like, okay, it's more work to present. It's a little bit more of a challenge. Well, so was Hakeem's murder from the fucking beginning, man. Like, it was a fucking challenge. Like, it doesn't mean we just say, oh, it's hard, I'm not doing it. Like, fuck that.
Fuck that. I'm with you. Thanks for doing this, Rob. I really appreciate it, because I feel very strongly about what has happened in this case and what is happening with this defendant. We can only hope that the prosecutors take this round of cases more seriously than they took the last. I mean, I understand he's got a federal firearm charge potentially out there. I don't know. But, you know, there's no excuse. I mean, how many bites of an apple is this guy going to get for killing people and shooting people and, like, basically terrorizing a city? I can't understand it.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate it.
He's hurt a lot of people, man.
He has, and he's going to keep doing it if he's allowed. So hopefully this might get some people's attention and something might get done. It's the only thing we can hope for. Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully it has an impact.
Yeah. There is no excuse for allowing Quezon Lee to plead to such a lenient sentence for the murder of Hakeem Clark. And the fault for this tragedy lands squarely on the Chatham County District Attorney's Office. Unlike some other professions where poor judgment or incompetence can easily be corrected, failures in the criminal justice system affect the whole community. The need for accountability in the criminal justice system is the reason so many important criminal justice leaders are elected. Yet the media largely ignores criminal justice failures like the plea for Quezon Lee. It's not unrealistic to expect prosecutors to know the law and to know how to prosecute a gang case, yet the current office, despite its high-salaried attorneys, can't deliver when good cases are handed to them. We deserve better, and we should demand more. Our next series hopes to give you an idea of what is possible. Stay tuned.